Devoted to coverage of social justice activists and activism here in the DMV, the nation, and around the blue planet. I'm Esther Averam. Well, listeners to the show know that we give attention to both the state of our environment and issues of the Just Us system. Well, today we're going to talk to the Prison Ecology Project about the intersection of these issues, mass incarceration, degradation of our environment, and economic repression in our communities. And then in the second half of the show, you'll drive the conversation for this month's installment of the F Word. So as always, we have a lot for you in this less than an hour, starting with lots of activism headlines. More than 5,000 people marched through the streets of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, on Monday to protest North Carolina's voting law that has eliminated same-day voter registration, reduced early voting by a week, prohibited out-of-county precinct voting, and eliminated pre-registration of 16- and 17-year-olds, among other provisions. the march dubbed Mass Moral Monday, passed by a federal courthouse where a trial challenging North Carolina's controversial election law started on Monday. The Reverend William Barber, president of the North Carolina NAACP, told WPFW's show What's at Stake that the current battle for voting rights in that state is today's equivalent to the fight for voting rights in Selma, Alabama, 50 years ago.
You've not seen this kind of attack against voting rights since the first Reconstruction of the 1800s. And they claim, as they did with poll taxes and grandfather clauses, that they were race neutral. Remember, that was the claim in the 1800s. That was the claim of Jim Crow. But it fell apart under the microscopic view of the Constitution. It's our Selma, because in these fights, we're trying to hold on to what we want in Selma. We are right now 49 years and 11 months from the anniversary of the signing of the Voting Rights Act that was won because of the Selma to Montgomery thing we did 50 years ago. So that's one thing. This is our Selma because we're literally, before we can go forward to talk about things like all people being registered at 18 and the universal federal standard for voting rights, we have to hold on to the victories of the past. That's number one. Number two, yes, it is a deep threat. You know, we've seen things in North Carolina as recent as 2008. For instance, one county commissioner put a casket with an effigy of Joe DePlumer and a noose and the name of President Obama on that casket parallel to an early voting site. We've had death threats in this fight for voting rights. So it's not exactly the same, but it is the same in the sense of trying to move this country forward. And then thirdly, it is our Selma, because what we're saying is Selma this year for us could not be a celebration. It had to be a consecration and a recommitment to the fight for justice. Because right now we are poised to break open the solid South and to undermine the white Southern strategy. 25 to 26% of the electorate in North Carolina is black. You get 3% Latino, that's 28%. You get 23% of Southern whites to vote their future, not their fears. The solid South begins to break apart. The same thing is in Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina, and other places. This is what this fight is about. It's about whether or not we will move into a kind of a third reconstruction, which I believe we're in the embryonic stage of, or whether we will take major steps backward.
In Baltimore this Saturday, the family of Tyrone West will mark the 2-year anniversary of his death after he was beaten by at least 10 police officers, including Baltimore police officers and one Morgan State University officer. On Saturday at 5 p.m., the West family will gather at the intersection of Kitmore and Kelway Roads in northeast Baltimore, where the incident all began, where West's family and witnesses say he was racially profiled while driving, stopped by two plainclothes Baltimore police officers, and then attacked. Tyrone West's sister, Tawanda Jones, told a recent gathering in Baltimore for the March to Justice about what her family has endured since her brother's death.
And from the corner of Kitmore, where my brother was brutally murdered, we stood in a parking lot where Anthony Anderson, right here in Baltimore City, brutally murdered in front of his mom, slammed on his head in front of his granddaughter on her birthday by the same unit. 17 days before my brother was brutally murdered, Abdul Salam was brutally attacked inches away from his life by the same two officers, Nicholas Davis Chapman and Officer Ruiz. And had it not been for my beautiful family putting together West Wednesday, because they killed the wrong man, but they truly got the right family. And we're just not here for Tyrone West. We're here for all the victims of police brutality. We just got the family, and please keep Freddie Gray's family in prayer. This man was brutally attacked right here in this city. So we just left his mother. We was even on a corner in New York City with Eric Gardner's mother. We met Michael Brown's mother when she came to Pastor Jamal's church. Please just keep all of us and all the families, and this is our fight. It's not an I and we. We all need to do it. We need to be a unified front. We need to change this corrupt system.
The family of Tyrone West invites the public to join them Listen to Tyrone's story and about the fight the West family has waged against police officers who have never been charged and who remain on the police force. That's this Saturday, July 18th, 5 p.m. at the intersection of Kitmore and Kelway Roads in Northeast Baltimore. And that protest will be a few hours after protesters in New York City will be marking the one-year anniversary of the death of Eric Garner, who was put in an illegal chokehold by police officer Daniel Pantaleo and then left to die on the sidewalk in Staten Island, New York. Also in Baltimore, a broad coalition of social justice organizations are protesting that thousands of residents have had their water shut off for delinquent bills as small as $250. At a recent hearing, city council members and residents accused Baltimore officials of unfairly targeting residents and not businesses as they attempt to collect more than $40 million in past due water bills from 25,000 accounts. In D.C., while the job market is considered rich with opportunity, too many retail jobs are part-time with no guarantee of full-time or even regular hours. That was the message Tuesday night at the Workers' Rights Board public hearing on the need for just hours. The D.C. Jobs with Justice Coalition says that too many workers in our community have jobs that grant too few hours on too short notice and require them to be at the beck and call of their employers. Protesting Walmart workers we spoke to last year echoed a similar sentiment in their call for $15 and full-time work.
Walmart, Walmart, you can't hide!
We can see your greedy side!
Walmart, Walmart, you can't hide!
We can see your greedy side!
Walmart, Walmart, you can't hide!
We can see your greedy side!
Isaiah Bayman, with the Capitol Plaza store, 5129, Landover Hills, Maryland.
Okay, why are you out here today?
Standing up for 15 an hour and consecutive hours, making a change at Walmart.
So what is it like now without that pay and the kind of job situation you have now?
Affecting this, me and associates, we getting by, but barely. I have associates, when they get their check, they don't know whether it's going towards food or their children, and that's kind of like... disgusting to me, knowing that they're the largest employer. They can do better.
Okay. You said something about consecutive hours. What are the hours like now?
Most people are getting under 30. And with that, it's cutting them from full-time to part-time, which is affecting their health care. So that's a big deal.
How so? Because if you don't have enough hours, you can't really afford the health care plan?
Right. And some people, they were brought in as part-time, but doing full-time hours, and they're cutting their hours now and they're making them part-time again, which is affecting their healthcare, Walmart healthcare.
My name is Fatima Tadiabi.
Okay. And where are you from?
I'm originally from Sierra Leone, but I came from Saudi Arabia.
Okay. And where are you living? Work in the area?
Yeah, I work in Alexandria, Virginia.
So why are you out here today? What's this all about?
It's all about $15 in full time, $15 per hour, because we want to be able to afford for our family, not just depending on government or welfare. We want to provide for our family, and Walmart can do that for us, because Walmart is one of the richest family. So, you know, they should provide for us too. We need $15 per hour and full-time, because even though they get paid 9 or 10 and full-time, they still rely on government, and that's definitely not fair. Your job needs to provide for you.
For more information about Tuesday's hearing, contact DC Jobs with Justice at dcjwj.org. That's DC Jobs with Justice at dcjwj.org. Also this week, as President Obama called for prison reform in a major address before the NAACP, an organizer with the Prison Ecology Project told a gathering at the Potter's House here in D.C. on Tuesday night of their plans to get the EPA to recognize environmental justice impacts on prisoners and an effort to stop the construction of a new prison on 700 acres of endangered species habitat in eastern Kentucky. The mission of the Prison Ecology Project is to map the intersections of mass incarceration and environmental degradation and create action plans to address the multitude of problems found there. We'll hear more about their work after headlines. And finally, in our culture and media moment, the organization Apache Stronghold requests all warriors and allies to join them next week here in Washington, D.C. to oppose the destruction of Sacred Oak Flat. Oak Flat, located in central Arizona, is sacred land to the San Carlos Apache tribe, but Congress traded it away last year to facilitate a huge copper mine for international mining giant Rio Tinto. The protest organizers say that the mine would destroy Oak Flat, where Native people have held religious and coming-of-age ceremonies for generations, and leave behind a massive crater, wiping out streams, springs, and wildlife habitat. San Carlos Apache Chairman Terry Rambler testified about the significance of Oak Flat in front of the Senate's Energy and Natural Resource Subcommittee in November of 2013.
We oppose this bill for three reasons. One, it will destroy our sacred areas. Two, it will deplete and contaminate the region's already overdrawn water supply. And three, it is a bad deal for the American taxpayer. I also serve as president of the Intertribal Council of Arizona, which represents 21 tribes in Arizona, and submitted testimony strongly opposing this bill. I have here a list of tribes and tribal organizations that represent over 400 tribal governments united in opposition to this bill. This opposition keeps growing. The bill would transfer 2,422 acres of our sacred land, known as Oak Flat and Tonto National Forest, to Resolution Copper to develop a massive copper mine. Oak Flat is a place of worship where our spiritual deities reside. Just as Mount Sinai is a holy place to Christians, Oak Flat is the equivalent for us. The Apache way is to respect and care for our relatives, which includes the animals and plants and their habitats that thrive at Oak Flat. Our God provides these living things to sustain life and for use in our ceremonies and prayers. Our people have always gone to Oak Flat to gather ceremonial items and to conduct ceremonial dances, such as the sunrise ceremony that celebrates a young woman's coming of age.
Members of Apache Stronghold are right now caravanning across the United States from Arizona and arrive in Washington, D.C. next week for a rally on Wednesday, July 22nd from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on the West Lawn of the U.S. Capitol. Protesters are opposing destruction of Oak Flat and also supporting legislation by Representative Raul Grijalva of Arizona to repeal the Oak Flat giveaway. For more information, go to apache-stronghold.com or call 928-475-6751 or 928-475-2931. That's apache-stronghold.com or 928-475-6751 or 928-475-2931. And those are our headlines and happenings for this week. When we come back, the intersection of criminal justice and environmental justice. Stay with us. This is On the Ground on 89.3 on WPFW. I'm Esther Averam. While the Apache people are waging a battle to spare their sacred ancestral lands from mining, my guest in this segment is working to spare rural lands in Appalachia from the construction of yet another prison and the expansion of the prison industrial complex. As President Obama called for prison reform in a major address before the NAACP this week, an organizer with the Prison Ecology Project told a gathering at the Potter's House here in D.C. on Tuesday night of their plans to get the EPA to recognize environmental justice impacts on prisoners, and about an effort to stop the construction of this new prison on 700 acres of habitat for endangered species in eastern Kentucky. The mission of the Prison Ecology Project is to map this intersection of mass incarceration, environmental degradation, and create action plans to address all those problems together. So the Prison Ecology Project was created by the Human Rights Defense Center in order to investigate, document, and take actions to address the ways in which mass incarceration degrades the natural environment and the human health of those inside or nearby prisons. So with me in the studio today to talk about that is Paul Wright, Executive Director of the Human Rights Defense Center, and he's also editor of Prison Legal News. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Esther. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for joining us. So first, tell me about this prison. Probably most of us have never heard about it. Where is it exactly? And it's on 700 acres in Kentucky?
What the Federal Bureau of Prisons is doing is they're proposing to build a maximum security prison in Leicester County in Kentucky. And this is an area that's been heavily mined for the past several decades. And as a result of the mining operations, the water is known to be contaminated. It has a lot of serious environmental issues. Some of the other things, it's also a habitat to the endangered Indiana bat, among other animals. And basically, the Bureau of Prisons is proceeding with wanting to build this prison in basically this impoverished rural Appalachian area that has already been devastated by decades of mining and environmental exploitation. And I think this is one of the longstanding patterns that we've seen, especially with the Federal Bureau of Prisons, but also with a lot of state prison systems, where they, after having depleted the land, ravaged the soil, destroyed the forests, killed the animals, the federal government's big idea of environmental reclamation is, hey, let's build a prison here. The federal prison complex in Florence, Colorado, for example, is the BOP's flagship facility. This is where they have the ADX facility, the Supermax, where, and it's interesting because when we hear the media had a lot of heavy coverage about the ADX recently over the Boston Bombers trial and the fact that upon conviction he was going to be dispatched to the ADX, but nary a word about the fact that the entire prison complex, which houses thousands of prisoners, is built on an abandoned uranium mine with all the attendant environmental effects that go along with that. So we think that these are pretty important issues, and the federal government has basically pretty much ignored them.
So we're talking about this intersection of the prison industrial complex and the fact that we are also intersecting this with the environment. So what made your organization kind of look at this, the combining of these two issues?
Well, we've been reporting on the news and on prison issues for literally 25 years now. And for a long time, we've reported on the environmental impact of prisons. In fact, I'd say we're probably the only ones that have done so in anything approximating a consistent or systemic manner. And what we're seeing is that over and over and over again, we see prisons are being built on abandoned coal mines, on abandoned uranium mines, on shut down military sites. A lot of these military bases that were shut down after decades of use by the military, the land is totally contaminated from decades of jet fuel and diesel and other toxic chemicals being literally just dumped into the ground.
It's interesting you say 25 years, because that's roughly, maybe it's been a little longer, that we've had this mass incarceration issue because of the so-called war on drugs. And I want to play President Obama's, just a little piece of President Obama's remarks from earlier this week and get your, your comments on those.
The United States is home to 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prisoners. Think about that. Our incarceration rate is four times higher than China's. We keep more people behind bars than the top 35 European countries combined. And it hasn't always been the case, this huge explosion in incarceration rates. In 1980, there were 500,000 people behind bars in America. 500,000 people in 1980. I was in college in 1980. Many of you were not born in 1980. That's okay. I remember 1980. 500,000. Today, there are 2.2 million. It has quadrupled since 1980. Our prison population has doubled in the last two decades alone.
So when I was listening to that, that was President Obama speaking before the NAACP earlier this week, I was just thinking about how it seems to me that prisons, policing, and militarization is like a jobs program. Like, especially when we're here in D.C. and we're so close to the DOD, we're so close to the Northern Virginia, like, I call them the DOD mansion land, you know? So where you have, like, the richest county filled with, like, basically military contractors. Isn't this mass incarceration and the construction of the kind of prisons you're talking about just tied together, like...
Absolutely, and I think that's one of those things is that there are flip sides of the same coin. Is when President Obama talks about the 2.2 million, which I think that number is a little low. I think it's closer to 2.5 million, but who's quibbling over a couple hundred thousand prisoners, right? I think that one of the things that isn't really talked about in terms of the economic impact that this has on labor markets is if you think about it, if these 2.5 million people weren't locked up, what would they be doing? No one is claiming there's jobs for them. But then on the other hand, you've also got to look at the fact that the jobs program aspect is that on one hand, you've got 2.5 million people who aren't working at all. And then you've got over 1 million people that are directly working for prisons and jails around the country. They draw a paycheck from mass incarceration. This is their job. This is what they do. So now you're talking 3.5 million people. And we're not even counting the police, the prosecutors, the public defenders, the judges, and the whole conveyor belt that gets people off the street and into prison. So, you know, when you factor that in, yeah, it is a vast jobs program. And I think one of the things that I've never really liked the term prison industrial complex because that implies that something of value is being produced.
Manufactured.
Right, and it isn't. All that the prison system does and the criminal justice system does is it takes tax dollars and it reappropriates them. And I think if you're looking at the prison system as a vast jobs program, the question is, you know, if we're just going to hire people to do stuff, can't we hire them to do more productive things than cage other people? And I would say, yes, we can. And this is America. We've done stuff before. I mean, you've got the Civilian Conservation Corps. You've got plenty of government jobs programs that have been very successful in American history that didn't involve killing and torturing and caging people. So if you're going to have a jobs program, we can do better than what we have now.
And, you know, I meant for you to have an opportunity to respond directly to President Obama's comments. I didn't mean to cut it off with another question, but I was just, it was on my mind.
Well, I think as far as President Obama's comments is, I mean, I think he's really stating the obvious. And I think it's like, okay, really? And it took him 35 years to notice. Where has he been? But the other thing is...
Because you've been saying that for years in Prison Legal News. And
well, to put this into context, when Prison Legal News started in 1990... there was 1 million people locked up. And basically you can say that it took the United States from 1776 when it became a nation until 1990, over 200 years to lock up its first 1 million people. Mm-hmm. And then it locked up its second 1 million people between 1990 and 2000. So, you know, I think that it's the exponential growth is kind of built into the system. And I think that's one of the things that again, I'm not a big fan of the term prison industrial complex, but I think, you know, if you're thinking in industrial terms, what industry has ever on its own said, we've grown too big, we have too much money, we have too much power, we need to stop now? They don't do that. The intrinsic nature of systems like this is to grow and grow and grow. And so far, I mean, we've heard a lot of rhetoric, but we haven't actually seen any action either on Capitol Hill or from our executive or legislative branches in this country.
Okay. So I want to make sure we get back to that whole idea about the nature of these systems is to grow, but we're going to actually go to a brief break. And this is my time when I actually invite our callers to join our discussion by calling 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. So we're going to kind of combine our conversation with Paul Wright, Executive Director of the Human Rights Defense Center, with this idea of privatization of prisons and our monthly discussion of the F word, the ways that we are and are not living in a pre-fascist society. 202-588-0893 will be the number to call. We'll go to a break and we'll be right back. Thank you.
We regret to announce the passing of Dr. Nana Sashibe. Services for Dr. Sashibe will be Friday, the 17th of July, 11 a.m., Howard University, Rankin Chapel, repast to follow at the Blackburn Center. She taught African languages in the Department of African Studies at Howard University. She was of Osha, Zulu, Sotho nobility and was a veteran of the anti-apartheid struggle and a trusted courier of classified information used in the movement to expose crimes of the apartheid regime. In 1972, Nana wed Moretide Jeremiah Sashibe. Both were stalwart members of the Pan-African Congress. In 1961, they witnessed countless friends die when South African police opened fire on demonstrators in Sharpeville. Again, services will be held for Dr. Nana Sashibe at Howard University, Rankin Chapel, repast follows at Blackburn Center this Friday, July 17th.
Y'all gonna make me lose my mind. Up in here, up in here. Y'all gonna make me go all out. Up in here, up in here. Y'all gonna make me act a fool. Up in here, up in here. Y'all gonna make me lose my cool. Up in here.
That was DMX on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition on WPFW 89.3 FM. And I'm Esther Avam, and I'm speaking to Paul Wright, Executive Director of the Human Rights Defense Center and Editor of Prison Legal News. And I'm also talking to you. You can join our discussion at 202-588-0893. But, you know, to kind of cue everything up again, you talked about how these systems perpetuate themselves. And we're talking about a system of increasingly privately run prisons. So in this segment that we've talked about on the F word, we've talked about how the corporate control of so much of the state, that's what we're using as our definition. Mm-hmm. Of the, and so how have you seen this impact prisons, prison life, and also this element of the environment in your tenure covering this, the private prisons?
I mean, basically what we've seen is the private prisons are nothing new in American history. Up until the 1920s, a lot of prisons were privately operated by private companies that exploited prison labor and killed prisoners in droves. And basically the death knell of private prison in this country was in the 1920s when the public became sickened by the corruption, the brutality, and the lawlessness of private prisons. They're largely abolished up until 1983 when Corrections Corporation was created and kind of recreated this bad saga in American history. And all I can say is that it's not turning out any better on the second go-around than it did on the first one. And so what we see with the private prison industry is basically, once more, we're talking about the privatization of public wealth in the form of our tax dollars and our tax infrastructure is being diverted into the hands of private shareholders and companies for profit. And some of the ways this manifests itself, and this isn't to say government prisons are any type of panacea or they're great. They're not. They're as bad, if not worse, than the private prisons. But the difference is that when the warden of the private prison denies prisoners medical care and people die, at the end of the year, he's getting a bonus for cutting down the company's costs on medical care. And the difference is that the State Departments of Correction or the head of the Federal Bureau of Prisons isn't hiring lobbyists to go lobby for longer sentences. And when there's talk of sentencing reform, they aren't lobbying legislatures and giving legislators money to stop the prison reform and stop sentencing change. Those are kind of the critical differences that we see. In terms of the overall operations, typically private prisons are characterized by their non-union workforce. And they're understaffing of facilities. And that's how they make their money. Because when we talk about prisons being a jobs program, 85% of the cost of running a prison is on the labor of the people that staff it. So if you can cut that, you can make more money.
Okay. So hold that point. You said something really interesting earlier I want to get back to. But we have a full bank of people waiting on the phone. So let me go to my first caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Okay. I hope it's me.
Yeah, you're on the air.
Okay. Hi, this is a great show, and your guest is so knowledgeable, and thank you both for keying on this issue. I really want to raise just one little thought in that issue. The people who are incarcerated are also workers. They are workers who are not employed. But this is a way that capitalism balances off its costs for running capitalism, and we can see one thing that's never ever seen by a lot of us is that people who are unemployed are workers. People who are in prison are workers. People who are on welfare are workers. We are all workers. And once we can see that, I think that some of the politics can lean more to identifying capitalism for what it really is and show that it is anti-worker.
Okay. You know, it's so interesting you said, is this Archie?
This is Rick.
Oh, it's Rick. Okay. Calling from D.C. You didn't follow the rules, but I know who you are. You know, what you're saying reminds me of the fact that I was either reading something or watching something recently, and they just talked about the prison population being surplus labor, that at one point, you know, workers were needed. You know, we worked in factories, especially black men. You know, they worked in factories. They had farming jobs. They did all kinds of jobs that have been either taken over by machines, exported overseas. And so that just reminded me of your comments. But thank you for calling and making those comments. Let me go to the next caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Calling from Harlem, New York.
Harlem, New York. All right. Harlem's in the house. Turn down your radio.
Okay. I'll turn it off. I'm just looking at my history, being a person that was caught up in the system, to where back in the 80s, I had a case which was nonviolent, you know, low possession of something illegal, and I did 1.5 to 3. So now I get another case with something illegal, nothing violent, I get 2.5 to 4. Right? And then I get another case, you know, caught up in a merry-go-round, I get another 2.5 to 4, which was illegal. But what happened is that through all the Industrial Slave Act that I was putting myself through, I had to say to myself, if I can go to these places and go to lunch, excuse me, go to child, go to the yard.
We have a kind of a bad connection. I'm not sure whether it's the speaker phone or what it is, but you're kind of fading out on me.
How do I sound now?
This sounds just as bad.
Okay, well, thank you for taking my call. I'll let the next speaker go.
Okay, but thank you for calling. Thank you for calling and weighing in. 202-588-0893. Did you have any comments for our callers?
Yeah, well, certainly I think the first one, Rick, I think that his point about prisoners being workers, I think, is absolutely right on. That is totally stating the case. And I think that one of the things that we have to remember is that it's not necessarily true to say that prisoners are unemployed workers. They're workers that have been taken out of the bigger workforce. But prisoners are being enslaved every day and forced to work. And literally in Texas, the states of Texas, the state of Florida, and Arkansas, for example, they don't pay prisoners anything, not even token wages, nothing. And, you know, we have a name for making people work at gunpoint with no pay. It's called slavery. Right. And that's one of the things that, you know, that I think a lot of people forget is they think that slavery was abolished by the 13th Amendment. And on the contrary, the 13th Amendment enshrined slavery and keeps it alive. By saying that slavery is outlawed unless it's as punishment for conviction of a crime.
Right. And so you have decades of men, black men on chain gangs. You know, there's a documentary called Slavery by Any Other Name that just talks about how people were just corralled, just for any reason stopped and called a criminal so they could be imprisoned and put to work.
Right. And it was convict labor that built the roads and the railways of the South after the Civil War. And again, so, you know, we have this long history of that, and I think the problem is a lot of people think that maybe this ended or somehow things are different. No, it's very much the same thing.
Yeah, we still have lots of callers, so let me go back to the phone lines. 202-588-0893 is the number that they're calling, and that you can call also. I'll go to the next caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Is it me?
Yes.
DJ Campbell, I'm calling from Bowie.
Okay.
And I'm very grateful to get some facts, and I'm wondering whatever happened about fraternity, equality, and liberty.
That's only for the French.
No, the French meant it for us, too. We just got to do something about saving our planet, and my question is what's happening to Americans? They're supposed to be running their government, not being victims of it.
Okay. Well, thank you for that comment. Yeah, I guess we're all wondering the same thing, and we're not only just wondering, we're here to fight the power here at your station for Jazz and Justice. 202-588-0893. Go to the next caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
My name is Neil. I'm from Winchester.
Oh, thanks for calling, Neil.
Yeah, and basically all I wanted to say was that when we live in a capitalistic society, the main goal of it, well, it cannot exist without slavery. And when you look back in history, that just seems to be the case. Now, I will say this. You brought up a good point about how these military contractors live out in Loudoun County, out in Fairfax, Prince William, wherever. I think if we are going to do some protesting, or you are going to do something, you need to take it to the house. Because when we do it in the city, we're putting ourselves in a position where they can surround you, spray you, and do all different kind of things to you. So when we read Sun Tzu's Art of War, you know, because we're waging a war, and we got to look at it like that. You got to think smart. Take it to the house. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
Peace.
All right, peace. 202-588-0893. I'll go to the next caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Yes. Joseph, I'm calling from Baltimore.
Okay. Go ahead. I hear a lot of car noise, but go ahead. I can hear you fine.
Okay, this is better?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm from southeastern Virginia, and there was once a lawsuit from these furniture companies who had sued this warden because he was allowing one furniture company to use his cheap labor, and he had lower prices than the rest of the furniture companies. So they took out a lawsuit, and it's very common for the warden to have contracts with corporations for that cheap labor. The 13th Amendment says slavery shall not be allowed within the jurisdictions except when a person has been duly convicted. So the 13th Amendment is written incompletely. It needs to be changed. That word except allows, that means slavery is still alive, and it's being used by corporations, and maybe they should look at rewriting the 13th Amendment to take out that word except. I had lots of debates with history professors in college about this. They say slavery is over. Well, like, read it. Except means it's not over. It's just been transferred into the presence. What do you think about that?
Well, I agree with you. I probably would have had some debates with my history professors also. You know, did you have any comments, Paul?
Yeah, no, I've written extensively about the issue of prison slavery and prison slave labor, and I wholeheartedly agree. And I think that's one of those things that, you know, whenever you see government officials taking these oaths of office saying that they swear to uphold the Constitution, and I'm kind of wondering, why are they swearing to uphold slavery? And I think that's one of the things that a sad thing, I think, is that in this country there's this reverence for the Constitution. But if you actually sit down and read it, it's like not all that great. And having been in prison myself, the part about being consigned to being a slave, that didn't go over too good with me when I was in prison, and now that I'm out, it doesn't go over too good with me either. And I think that's one of the things that needs to change.
Okay. 202-588-0893. I think we still have some callers on the line. Say your first name and where you're calling from.
Tespa, good morning.
Good morning, Tespa.
there is an element of ideology and an element of fascism in the prison system. If investigated logically, why so many people are arrested, why so many people are arrested for so long, cannot be justified. So there has to be an emotional element included in it to blind people why the government does this. In places like America, there has to be an element of racism to justify what is happening to the people arrested.
Okay.
In other places, there has to be an element of ethnicism. Like in Ethiopia, the ethnic group that is in the ethnic elite that is in power is Tigrayan.
Okay. Thank you, Tesfa. So we do have another caller. So just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon. I just want to make a comment.
Just speak up a little bit.
I want to make a comment towards your show. My name is TJ.
Mm-hmm.
And Esther, there was a problem earlier when I called. I said, let me try back because it's a really touching thing to me to get my feelings off.
Oh, okay. Thanks for calling back. Yeah, we can hear you much better now.
Right. Yeah, because I was driving. Being in the prison system, you know, like I was saying earlier, I was there three times, and I learned from the third time that if you do what they tell you to do and bring it out here, you shouldn't go back, because my last time caught up in that system was March the 5th, 1999. I'm a successful man. I have my own house. I have my own car. You know, I'm doing what's right today. But being that you can be in a system that's designed, now that I'm outside looking at what Obama said in the 80s, yes, we was all young. I was young in the 80s. But now that you're saying that you came from a million to 2 million, 3 million, 4 million human beings in a system, that has to be a setup. Thank you for letting me share again and enjoy your beautiful Thursday.
Okay, thank you. So one of the things that I found really fascinating, like trying to prepare for the show, was listening to the conference that you were involved in earlier this year. I think it was on the West Coast.
Yes, in Oregon.
Yes, and so I wanted to play some comments from Max Rameau, because he kind of talked about, you know, how he was looking at this issue, this intersection of mass incarceration and the environment. And I thought he had some interesting comments, so let's go to his comments.
The police then are an occupying force in black communities throughout the United States. I think it's important that we understand this, particularly as we talk about how we resolve the problems of policing in black communities. We understand the police are an occupying force, and therefore the solution to the problems that we're having now and the flare-ups that we're having now is not to end racism, but to end the occupation and end occupation of black communities. There's no way we can organize towards ending racism. We can, however, organize towards ending occupation and ending colonial relationships, and that's what we need to be moving towards. So the police then are able to enforce conditions because of the force that they bring with them and the power of the state and the legitimacy of the state, but really because of the guns and the ability to put people in prison. They're able to enforce conditions of environmental racism, which are hazards in low-income communities, environmental hazards in low-income communities. But they also have the dual role then of serving, as many colonies do, as a dumping ground for products and also as a testing ground for products. And in this case, as it relates to police and police states, as a testing ground for police tactics and actions, police actions, the behaviors of police, which then would go out to broader communities eventually if they're tested properly and work out in low-income black communities. So who cares and what's the connection here? So the black communities then end up being the testing ground for police work and for certain police tactics and actions. And there are concerns about what the police are doing to the ecological movement here. Then the best way to know what the police are going to be doing towards ecological activists in 10 years is to look to see what police are doing in black communities today. That is the greatest insight you will have into what the police are going to be doing in the direction in which to do it. They're going because they're going to be able to test out those strategies and tactics and methods in low-income communities, low-income black communities that have very little political power to resist that and little support to resist outside of that.
Wow. So I wanted to play that to kind of bring us back to this whole issue of this intersection between mass incarceration, policing, what we call we call the military-industrial complex, right, or the prison-industrial complex, that conveyor belt. Maybe the conveyor belt is a better analogy. So I wanted to bring us back to that issue of that intersection. So what about, do you have any follow-up to what Max was saying?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that one of the things is that policing in America, I think there's a notion that when people are in cities that that somehow the police are better in rural areas. And I lived for 10 years in Vermont, and Vermont is probably the whitest, least racially diverse state in the country. And all I can say is, you know, the police kill a lot of white people in rural white areas, too, because that's what they do. And they're not any better at policing poor people or mentally ill people that are white than they are in communities of color or poor people anywhere. But I think that the key thing that I think that Max says that I think that really resonates and I think is true nationally is that it's poor people around the country nationally, regardless of race, that are bearing the brunt of the American police state. That goes from the policing to the sentencing to the conditions of confinement and where the prisons are actually being built. And it's one of those things. It's when we talk about mass incarceration, one of the things to keep in mind is through the 90s, the United States was opening up a new prison almost every 2 weeks. For an entire decade, they did this. Mm-hmm. And if you look at where the prisons were built, for the most part, they're built in rural white areas far from the urban centers that generate the bulk of the prisoners. And I think this is part of the thing of these policies of further isolation and isolation and alienation deliberately of the people that are being imprisoned. You know, take them far from their families, sever off all their contacts with families and their communities, and then act surprised that you have high recidivism rates.
So if people want to find out more about this prison in Eastern Kentucky, is it?
Yes.
Where can they find out more information?
They can go to prisonecology.org, and we have a lot of stuff there as far as what we're doing on the environmental issues in prisons. They can also go to prisonlegalnews.org if they want to know more about what's happening with the overall prison system and jails and everything else around the country. We also have several other different projects, one of which is our Prison Phone Justice Campaign is about the work we're doing to get the Federal Communications Commission to limit the cost of prison and jail phone calls, which this has been a huge burden on poor communities nationally as telecoms and prisons and jails financially exploit people who want to stay in touch with their loved ones, and they get these monopoly contracts by giving kickbacks to the government. So,
okay. Well, I want to thank my guest, Paul Wright, Executive Director of the Human Rights Defense Council, I'm sorry, and also editor of Prison Legal News. And I want to thank everyone for listening and for calling in this morning. That will do it for us on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Avaram. Again, thanks to my guest, Paul Wright, of the Human Rights Defense Center. See, I should have stuck to the script. and the Prison Ecology Project, prisonecology.org, right?
Yes.
And thanks to our engineer, Gio Risanello, for achieving mighty feats this morning, and also to Michael Byfield for production assistance on today's show. And thank you so much for listening, calling in, and supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. If you'd like to work on the show, we have open positions for volunteers and interns. Write us at contact@onthegroundshow.org. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice. Peace. We'll be right back.
I didn't mean to take up all your sweet time. I'll get right back to you one of these days.